Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. My guest today is an award-winning author. He's known as a writer's writer. He's designated a triple threat: novelist, short story master, prolific essayist. But most of all, if you ask Peter Orner what he wants, it's to connect, especially with those readers who can't not read. Well, whether you're one of those readers or not, I'm sure you will enjoy Still No Word From You, Peter's new collection. So let me tell you a little bit about him and we'll bring him right on. Peter Orner is the author of two novels and several story collections, including Maggie Brown and others. His previous collection of essays, Am I Alone Here? Notes on Living to Read and Reading to Live, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Criticism. Peter's work has appeared in the Best American Short Stories, the New York Times, the New Yorker, the Atlantic, the Paris Review, the creme de la creme. The list is long. He's a three-time recipient of the Pushcart and has received many other awards, including the Rome Prize from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and a Fulbright in Namibia. Peter Orner's the director of creative writing at Dartmouth College, and again, his latest collection of essays is Still No Word From You, Notes in the Margin. And here's my guest, Peter Orner. Peter Orner, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Great.
I'm really pleased to have you. I haven't read any of your work before, and I was thrilled. I'm always thrilled to find new authors and new great books. And Still No Word From You, Notes in the Margin, makes for a really interesting read. But, you know, we haven't chatted before, so I always like to share a little of our guest's background with listeners. You have a really interesting background along the way to becoming where you are now, as many of us do. We have a whole bunch of different and weird jobs, and some of the jobs I saw that you'd had were counselor, wilderness trip leader, and village director in Wisconsin. You worked as a human rights observer in Mexico. Taught in Namibia, you were a cab driver in Iowa City, a sewer department worker in Illinois. You also have a law degree. So what point did you become serious about becoming a writer and writing?
Thinking about the job as a sewer worker, I was the smallest one on the crew. This is actually in high school, but I was the smallest one on the crew, so they would send me down for particularly difficult jobs that nobody else could fit.
Like the old chimney sweeps used to send the kids up the chimney.
And all those fumes. I mean, it was intense. Anyway, this is the only thing I've done a lot of things, as you say. This is the only thing I've been able to really do with any kind of consistency or, you know, I think it's sort of what I was born to do. I'm lucky in that sense. And I've been telling stories and writing stories, you know, kind of since the sixth grade when I made up a story about an electric socket. That was my great beginning. But anyway, yeah, I'm lucky. It's sort of what I do, what I've always done.
Yeah, but I think these side jobs that we take along the way when we're kids and finding our feet always add some detail to storytelling as we go along.
Oh, for sure. In fact, I think every one you mentioned I have used for a story.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. And so at some point you decide to take an MFA. Why did you decide to take the MFA in creative writing? Why did you go that route versus plunging into going solo?
Yeah, you know, I like a lot of people, I was sort of trying to figure out what to do. At that point, I'd gone to law school and I knew that I would make the world's worst lawyer. I think I was going to be a criminal defense lawyer, and the criminal defendants out there are lucky that I am not out there peddling my services at this point. But I was actually running from law loans at that point, and graduate school shielded me from those. But more more significantly, it gave me time to focus and some time to think, and that was the greatest gift of all of it. I mean, you don't need to go to graduate school for writing. I'd say that to anybody. But if there's a way to give yourself the gift of time, which that did for me, that was a great boon.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at that. A gift of time is a very special thing to give to yourself too, that space to learn and grow. So let's talk a little bit about this new book, Still No Word From You, Notes in the Margin. This is a series of essays, some memoirs, some you reference, I think it was like 106 other authors or stories throughout the book. So tell us, for readers who are not and listeners who have not heard of this, what it's about.
Sure. This is my seventh book, and I decided, I was going to do whatever the hell I wanted to do. I hope I can say that on the air. It was, I just thought, all right, I'm going to write the book that I would like to read, and I never saw it out there. The book I wanted to read was a book that sort of crystallized how reading is related to memory. And what I find, and I'm sure you find this too, is when I read something that is particularly powerful, my mind will often stray off the page, and it will engender a memory, right? And I wanted to sort of track that idea. So I sort of, every morning before I got to work on another project, I would take notes on what I was reading. And I would take notes on what I was reading and what kind of memories it gave me. Because but for certain things that I've read, I would not have remembered certain stories. And so the book sort of took shape in that way. I would read and remember, read and remember.
Yeah, and I very much relate to what you're saying, having read through your book, because as I was reading your stories, it jogged memories of some of my own stories. And I pulled a couple of those out so we can talk about those a little later. One of the things that I've been talking to people a lot about lately, Matthew Dix, who's a moth champion, he wrote, I think it was Tomorrow Is Today, and Gary Lipman, who wrote a book of one-sentence stories, is that a story, it does not have to be a big idea, a monumental concept or profound to make a big impact on people. And that's evidenced throughout your book, because some of these stories are two or three pages and some are half a page. So talk to us a little bit about how you put this together from that perspective.
Yeah, I think what I would say is that what I have come to believe is that even though I love novels, and I have written two of them, and I'm working on one right now, this morning, it's not going that well, but I've come to believe that the stories of our lives are fragmentary. Like, it's not all one thing. It's not an arc that kind of, you move through time in an especially consistent way. And I think I wanted to tell the stories of my own family in the way that they really happened and the way that we remember them, which is, haphazard, scattershot, and yet that starts to build and build and build, and that forms a picture of a family. And what I find that when I'm with my family and we're swapping stories, we're often telling the same stories over and over again. Why do we do that? It's not that we haven't heard them before. It's that these stories, these fragmentary stories, these stories that sort of come and go, are really, what make up our lives. And so I wanted to try and capture that on the page.
Yeah, and it's true of my family, great storytellers. My grandparents, both sides, were great storytellers and had lots and lots of stories that sometimes grew a little as the night went on.
Right.
When they
change. I mean, the story that you've been hearing for years, suddenly there's a new wrinkle that you hadn't heard.
That's
either somebody was holding something back or they're inventing. Either way, it's great.
That's right, yeah. One in particular I loved was when my grandfather was in the First World War and they had to lean on these poles across a trench to go to the bathroom and the latrine. And one night he fell in. Because he said he had a fever, and my grandmother was convinced, no, he'd been drinking with the French women in the village, and he was drunk. That story grew legs as it went on overnight. But
I can tell why.
But one of the stories that I think illustrates that is this story and how we see things differently too as siblings and as friends, and we remember the same situation and we see them differently. One of the stories in your book that really illustrates that is when your mum was driving in a snowstorm and she skidded and basically got stuck in the snow, and your dad wouldn't go pick her up. And you write about that, but your brother doesn't even remember that happening.
Right, right. It's actually the last piece in the book. I was driving with my mother coming home from Chicago one night, driving to our hometown, and she pointed it to an exit and said, "Hey, that's where I walked off the expressway during the snowstorm of '78." And I'd never heard the story before. And, you know, my dad was not heroic. I hadn't heard that before, although I was not surprised. But it was interesting that my brother, who was older, it took me bringing the story to him and him not remembering and then calling me back a couple hours later and it starting to come to him that night. And I just think that we're never done telling the stories of our childhoods, right? They keep coming back. I'm especially interested in siblings and how siblings, you know, have different memories that are, you know, that track each other and they kind of build off each other. And again, also may invent each other in a way.
That's true. Very interesting. I read that you wrote this during the pandemic, the book during the pandemic. So talk to us about that experience, because I've heard you say you need stimulus to write your stories for inspiration, you know, as many of us do. So writing this book in the pandemic was probably a very different experience, I'm imagining.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I spend much of my days when I'm working sort of wandering around with a pen in my hand and a notebook, you know, walking. And while I did that a lot during the pandemic also, there was a sense of, I mean, I wasn't getting the street life, even though I live in a fairly small town in Vermont. There was still a lot of things. I could go to the post office and pick up stories, right? And at that point, you know, things were just so shut down, and I felt, you know, kind of isolated from where I was going to get my stories from. And I think, like a lot of us during that time, during that awful time, you know, so many losses, I turned inward. And I realized that, you know, I was carrying around much of the things I wanted to say in this book, is that the stories were there. They were just waiting for me to sort of find them.
I read that you said a lot of your work grows out of feeling alone while you're with other people, as something probably many people can relate to. So maybe it's always about needing to feel isolated, whether alone or not. Would you just elaborate on that a little?
Sure. I mean, for me, you know, being alone is essential to my work. You know, I have to be alone, and yet I'm somebody who craves company. You know, there's like a Neil Young song where he debates this issue of staying home and writing a song or going to the party that you can hear down the street, right?
Yeah.
And I think I'm like that. I'm almost torn between, you know, wanting to dive in and be among people and needing the space and the isolation, you know, to tell my stories, which come to me quietly in my own head, and I need that space in order to get them out, you know. But it's this constant tension because being with people feeds those. And so I actually try and think of ways to be alone with other people. There was a great anecdote of Charles Dickens that he actually would sit in the corner of a party and write. I love that idea. You know, so I actually, you know, I'm always sort of working even when I'm among my friends and they laugh at me.
Yes, well, even if we're doing it subconsciously, it's still going on upstairs, right?
I mean, our minds are constantly elsewhere, which is something I'm fascinated by, how we can be in, you know, simultaneously in eight places at once. I think it's something I actually tried to capture in a few of the pieces in the book.
Yeah, and going back to your point about tension, we need that tension of stimulus and that quiet time to think. I spend a lot of time, or most of my free time, in nature because that's where I clear my head and think. You write, there's a story, I think it was the first story in the book, where your mother's washing the dishes and the news is on, I think, and Nixon's helicopter is is rising into the air. And you write that you weren't sure of the actual date. You could look it up, but it's exhausting being able to check anything and everything. So we're in that state where we have so much stimulus all the time. How do you find that balance for yourself?
I really deliberately, I wanted to say that up front, that I am not even exhausted. Like, I resent being able to check when mm-hmm. Nixon resigned. I wanted to have my memory and looking out the window at the way the trees looked and sort of gauge what month it was from my memory, as opposed to checking it on Google. And I think there's something oppressive about this need for confirmation. And I think that it goes against the storytelling that I'm trying to do, which is coming out of memory, which is imperfect. And it turns out that Nixon resigned in August. In my memory, it's May.
Right.
May in Chicago, and I'm sticking to it. Right. I don't care if someone writes me and says, hey, it was actually August, because they could check it on Google. I checked my memory, which I had a lot more fun doing, and it took more time.
Right. Yeah. It's a struggle, I think, to be informed and to do the work that you need to do for research and still get that quiet time.
Right. I wouldn't recommend my method to reporters. Right? It's a special thing that I can do, that I can just own it, because I'm talking about memory and I'm talking about the imperfection of memory, not, facts and important other stuff in life.
Yeah. One of my favorite stories in the book, let's talk about that. It was, you write about James Salter's Mrs. Chandler character from Dusk, which I've not read, but you described it beautifully. And there's a moment when she's very elegantly dressed and she looks out a store window. You write, there's more to the story, but lately you find yourself drawn to the moments before a story becomes a story. What does that mean to you?
It's such a great question. Thank you for bringing it up. It brings up that story, which is so conjures, it's a beautiful images in my mind. But you need not have read it. You know what I mean? And that's something I actually wanted to emphasize in this book, is that while I'm talking a lot about writers, I'm trying to match them with my own experience, and it doesn't necessarily, it's not a test. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I think what I meant there is that the upshot of a story, in that particular story, something happens with Mrs. Chandler and the memory of her life that has gone south. But I wanted to isolate as a reader, and as somebody who's just sitting at my desk remembering the story as opposed to reading it, I wanted to isolate on that moment where she just looks out the window and sees into the past. I just wanted to stop right there.
Yeah.
And I compare it to, reading stage directions at the beginning of a play, right before anything has happened, when it's just kind of setting things out. I love that. And I think that sometimes it's nice to just pause there, and that's what I wanted to do. Just pause before the beginning of a story, before we get the upshot, before we get the information that we need.
Yeah.
I want to pause.
And it's very effective because it evoked a lot of emotion in me, and so that just proves the point that you don't have to have, 73 pages describing something to get an impact. So do you have favorite stories? I won't ask if you have a favorite story, but do you have favorite stories yourself, and is there one that you'd like to share and why you included that in the book?
Sure. Would you like me to read it or just talk
about
it?
Yeah, read it to us if you have it handy. Great.
Sure, yeah. There's a story, I won't read the whole thing, but I'll maybe read a couple of paragraphs. It's me remembering watching Muhammad Ali on television in 1980, fighting Larry Holmes and losing, because at that point Ali was old and slow and he was just doing it for the money. And it was a really painful fight to watch. And I remember watching it alone in the den of my house. And just, Ali was this, incredibly larger-than-life figure, and I loved him like everybody else in the world. And it was painful to watch him, come back down to earth, as he did so many times in his life, right? He wasn't a person that was afraid to come back down to earth, but it was particularly painful in 1980, and I'll just read a little bit because there's a moment that I remembered that I wanted to talk about, and that is, so I'll start here, round 5, 6, 7, 8, it no longer matters, and you'd think Holmes would start to take it a little easy, but Ali's making twice as much, win or lose, and so Holmes has a point to make. Holmes wasn't a great fighter, which captures the essence of a final truth. Eventually, mediocrity beats the shit out of everyone. Holmes was a workaday heavyweight who'd once been Ali's sparring partner, so there's poetry in it, too. Ali, of course, understood this, given his genius for being all things to all people. The hired help is champion now, as it should be. I don't believe Ali ever begrudged Holmes the beating. A dull fight, what I allowed myself to see of it. Ali held up his gloves to protect his face, and Holmes almost gently swatted them aside and clobbered with the same overhand right to the head again and again and again. And then it became a thing. After every round, Ali would retreat to his corner, but he would not sit. It was as if to give in to his knees now would have meant remaining on that stool forever. And his standing there like that was a lot worse than the fight itself. His cornermen shouting, cajoling, pleading, "Sit down, Muhammad, please, please." But he was no longer capable of hearing anything. I could tell this from Chicago, alone in front of the TV in the den. There may have been other people in my house, but I was alone, and I wanted to whisper in his ear, "Mr. Ali, even my own brother won't talk to me." And also, screw Don King, who arranged the fight. Anyway, gives you a little idea.
Right, right. And why did you want to include that? Tell us why that was important to include.
I think because it was something that was so vivid in my memory, and that, again, I didn't need to go back, and now you can. You can watch it on YouTube, right? But I wanted to replay that fight in my head as I remembered it. And so I didn't go back and watch it. I just tried to track the specificity of what I remembered. And one thing I did remember, and I do think I have this right, is that he didn't sit down between the rounds. Mm-hmm. At least some of the rounds, he didn't sit down. And that's pretty remarkable in a fighter. And I thought, you know, what an image, metaphorical image of somebody who is getting beaten but won't sit down on the stool. And it seemed to kind of track a little bit of what I was trying to do in this book, in the sense of I was trying to recreate memory on the page without worrying too much whether or not it was round 7 or round 8 or whatever, because I'm thinking about myself as a little kid and how this impacted me, not how I'm looking at it now.
Yeah, very cool. I ran into him in a shopping mall of all places in San Diego. Yeah, and he said, my mum was like, "Go have your picture taken." I'm like, "No," but he grabbed me and we took our picture.
That's the best. Wow. I mean, that's like seeing Jesus. I mean, that's great.
I know. And when the photos were developed, it was way back, right? I'm standing there looking all pensive. I was like, oh dear. Embarrassed by my mother again, right? So you've been a professor of English and creative writing for a long time. I've heard you say that teaching keeps you honest. Tell us about that.
You know, because the students see right through you if you try and, BS this, and they know. And I feel like when I stand up in front of them, I'm not, like, there's no big an expert at this. It's not like I'm teaching chemistry or teaching, how to fly a plane or something. I'm teaching something that changes every day, that I struggle with myself, that there are lots of times, most of the time, I have no idea what I'm doing. And so for me to stand up there and say, "Here's how to do this," it would never work. And so I'm always as honest as I can. I'm like, "Look, this is a struggle. We're creating stuff here, and it could go really wrong. In fact, most of the times it will." And, it's something I try and own. And, I think, the people who maybe don't teach as well this particular subject are the people who walk in the door and say, "Here's how to tell a story." There's no way to do that, and I think that's driving without a license.
Yeah. You say as you've got, more experienced, older, whatever, you worry less about craft and more about just giving something a shot. Do you think that's just experience, comfort level, bravery, feel more brave?
I suppose, and I do think it's sort of combined with the fact that, like, it just doesn't get like easier. It's like I, you know, every time I'm telling a story, it's you know, the challenges of it are always how to hold you, like how to hold you, how to interest you, right? And so all the crafty things we could talk about, you know, point of view and all this other stuff, are I guess becoming less and less relevant in my mind as I'm making stuff, you know, and maybe because they're so ingrained, but I think it has to do more with the fact that maybe I'm concentrating more on what's elemental, which is I just want to get people to care.
Yeah. Yeah, and that and connect. And I know there are many people who, you know, beginning writers who get locked into, if I have the perfect equipment, the perfect pen, the perfect notepad, it's all going to come together, and they want to know all these questions. But you do write longhand first, as I understand it, and I'm wondering what that gives you that writing on a computer doesn't give you for your first draft.
I think the first thing I would say is it's why I tend to write short pieces, because my hand starts to hurt, and that's just the literal truth of it. If I wrote on a computer, I'd probably write longer chapters and longer stories. But you know, I think what it does, it's a more physical thing for me. You know, it's like literally there's more sort of physical involvement in using a pen than banging out on a computer that's gonna like auto-correct you and things like that. I think it's, you know, it's more between me and the story, it feels like, to me, and I'm not making any judgment on the great writers who use computers. It's just me.
Yeah, and people talk for hours about what makes a good story. What works for Peter Orner when you're looking, or an idea pops, or a thought runs through your head, or you see a moment in time? When do you know you've got a good story?
Yeah, I used to say, to answer that question, and this is the kind of BS I would sometimes tell my students, the best story is a story that needs to be told, which I think sounds good, but then I'm like, I don't know, really? That, you know, so I backed away from that, and I, for me, now, it has to do with if something is vivid, if I can see it, you know, if I can just see it, and that relates pretty directly to character. Like, I want to see the people, you know, and depth of character is probably the most important thing for me. And if I can, when I'm reading a story, if there's characters who feel alive to me, I'm in. And if I'm writing a story and those characters are starting to feel alive to me, I'm in.
Yeah. Now, when you were writing Still No Word From You, did you go out and in your head make a list of the stories that you wanted to include, not necessarily your memoir stories, but authors? Or did that kind of come to you as you were writing it? Did you come across those books randomly? Because you're talking like 106 references, I think.
Yeah, you're totally haphazard. You know, I love, you know, do you have these little libraries out in Seattle? I'm sure you do.
Yeah, yeah.
You're walking down the street and there's like something in front of someone's house, there'll be a little library.
Yeah.
I love those.
Yes.
And I get a ton of books from those. I actually I make the rounds in Vermont and New Hampshire, checking little libraries to see what's in there. So it's always like serendipity. It's always a book that sort of comes my way, you know, kind of by accident. And I'll usually take it and run with it. And, you know, a lot of times it has to do with me just kind of looking at my shelf in the morning and seeing what's there, you know. And so there was never any plan, but it, like, I think a leading life is its own thing, you know. It became like a plan because that's how I was living my life through these particular books at that time. So they track, you know, my reading life over a 3-year period. But my reading life could not be more haphazard. I'll read a book in translation. I'll read a book from, you know, a Swedish author today, and when I finish that, I'll pick up a Russian, and maybe after that, you know, somebody from Kenya.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great way of getting exposed to more people too, doing it that way. You know, I know people who write their list for the year, but I think just randomly coming across stuff. I love to browse old bookstores. It was the worst part of the pandemic for me.
Most bookstores are the greatest because there isn't any semblance of order. I get a little bit, frankly, you know, it's my livelihood, and I hope people go to a new bookstore and buy this book, but what I love to do more than anything is to go to a used bookstore. or where it's just dependent on who dropped that book off or who died and the bookstore owner went through an estate sale. And there's no real rhyme or reason, but there's no real rhyme or reason why certain people live in a certain neighborhood in Seattle, right? It's just like, I love that randomness, and that's what a used bookstore captures.
Yeah. So as an author of long-form and short-form fiction and memoir, what is the biggest challenge for you, Peter?
I would say the biggest challenge when I'm writing nonfiction is telling the truth. You know, that, because I'm programmed as a fiction writer to make stuff up. And I think when I wrote this particular book, I really did my best to tell the truth as I understood it, as I remembered it, without sort of adding details just because they would make the story a little better, which is something I would certainly do if I was writing fiction. So I think the difference between fiction and nonfiction for me is there's this constraint, which can be exciting, right? It can be,
absolutely.
You know, it's a thing that kind of holds you back, and sometimes that can be better.
Peter, you've been described as a writer's writer. What does that mean to you?
It's a little, it's such a, I'll take it. I'll take whatever. You know what I mean? I just, like any writer, I want to be read. To me, it does indicate that those who do read me kind of have a special, there's a connection. There's a, and so I feel like, it's a compliment in that sense. But I think what you said is I want to be read by readers as much as I want to be read by writers. And I think this book in particular, as you said, is a book for those people who can't not read.
Right.
And I feel like we don't pay enough attention to those people.
Right. Well, that's a great note to end on. Peter Orner, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. The book is called Still No Word From You, Notes in the Margin. I know listeners can find out much more about you and your work at peterorner.com. A final word you'd like to leave listeners with today?
Just, Vicky, that I'm honored to be with you, and I would say read whatever the hell you want and leave it at that.
That's perfect. Peter Orner, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Vicky. See you later.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicky's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.